Welcome to the Radio Book Club. It is a collaboration between KGNU Community Radio and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran, News Director here at KGNU. My co-host, as always, Arsene Kashkashian of the Boulder Bookstore, joining me with another returning author, another local author. Delighted to have in studio Gregory Hill. Tell us about the selection we've been reading this month.
Well, we're reading The Zebra Skin Shirt, which is volume three of the Stratford County Yarns, a Stratford County yarn. And there's some commonality with the previous two books, East of Denver and The Lonesome Trials of Johnny Riles. And it's just a great book. It's a lot of fun. And Greg just spins a great yarn. I love the word yarn as part of what this trilogy is.
It's great to have you in the studio, Greg.
It's great to be here. And I love being at KGNU. I do my yoga every morning to Amy Goodman.
Oh, good to know. That's usually not the soundtrack to many people's yoga. It's not always terribly relaxing, but I appreciate that you're doing that.
Doing yoga helps me accept the bad news.
Yeah.
I like that. Well, Greg, this is your second visit to the book club. You were here previously for The Lonesome Trials of Johnny Riles, the second in the trilogy. Now, I'm going to probably annoy some folks here. I say zebra. Well, you say zebra.
I say zebra.
I say zebra.
I don't care how you say
okay,
it.
Okay, I wasn't sure if you were attached. It. Well, I read it and I loved it. And then I had to go back and reread the first book in the trilogy, East of Denver. So the three books are here. We're going to talk about the third one here, Zebra Skin Shirt.
Very well.
And that refers to a basketball referee's shirt, right?
Precisely. Because it's striped just like a zebra.
And there's the protagonist in the book is Narwhal, who is himself a basketball referee. You touched on basketball in the previous book,
yes.
Johnny Riles. What's your own personal connection to basketball, particularly basketball in Denver?
Well, let me just state that when I was in high school, I played basketball at Liberty High School in Joes, Colorado, ladies and gentlemen, the school which in 1929 won the state tournament and went to nationals and got third. My great uncle was on that team.
That was before your time, though.
Way before my time. But it's the own, well, now it's the second thing that Joes is known for. I'm just kidding.
You're the first, of course.
But what is my point? Oh, about when I was in high school playing basketball, I loved writing, I loved making music, but I would have these dreams where I was dunking the basketball, playing guitar, and writing a book at the same time. I can't, I'm not really explaining why I love basketball so much, but for some reason it is fused with my other two favorite activities in my mind. And I love the Denver Nuggets. And I think Nikola Jokic is the most handsome man on earth.
So Narwhal, 6'8", referee.
Yes.
He's not your typical referee. And you have this little thing here where he says, as a referee, I altered rules to fit my moods. I did this because it was the only way to guarantee that the correct team won. So we are alerted right away that Narwhal's got a few quirks, perhaps.
He's got some quirks, and this is a great entry point, an intersection between basketball and literature, which most people don't assume even exists, that intersection. But what we have here as the referee is the arbiter of truth. It is, we could describe the media as the arbiter of truth, and you can create your own truth if you have the right audience. And in the case of basketball game, you've got Narwhal, who understands that the game is entertainment. So he turns it into something more like professional wrestling, where he wants the crowd to leave happy and satisfied. And he, like, there's this scene where he describes where he officiates the intramural basketball game between stoners and fraternity brothers. And he does not like the frat boys. So he concludes after the game, because I think the score was 1,000,000,000 to nothing. Or something like, anyway, he decides, he says, in my world, the stoners win every time. So he imposes his own, so which then leads into his, I'll let you answer me the next question. Ask me.
I was just going to say, he has this philosophy that the winners leave happy and the losers leave mad at the ref. Like, regardless of what the ref does, that's how it's going to end. So as the ref, he may as well tailor this to be more entertaining. He doesn't like blowouts. He wants close games, right? He likes underdogs.
And every once in a while, like in one of the games, he fouled out almost every single player and made some cheerleaders start playing on the team. Because he wants to, because he loves to create chaos, give hope to the underdog, and there's some other thing that he loves to do. But it's just making things interesting, unpredictable, which, as an author, I can relate to.
So Narwhal finds himself in a very unpredictable situation. He's at a diner on coming home from a road trip in East Colorado, and he's comes out of the diner's bathroom, and time seems to have stopped.
Yes.
And that's the conundrum that he has to deal with.
And then left with this conundrum to deal with, he immediately... Let me back up a second. He's now trapped in a survival situation. And when one is in a survival situation, I mean, you're floating in a boat in the ocean, or you're stuck on a mountain, whatever. There are a couple things that you should not do. And one is do not panic. And two is don't freak out, which is the same thing. But so Narwhal does neither of those things. I wanted him to embrace this isolation. Everybody in the world is a mannequin. Birds are just stuck in the air. If he lets go of an object, it hovers where he left it. And it's exciting for him, rather than being despondent and being, you know, terrified that he can't speak to his girlfriend to whom he was about to propose, who's sitting at the table in the diner. He's like, screw it, let's go have some fun.
Well, he's the kind of guy who's going to propose with an onion ring that he picked up off the bathroom floor.
Yes.
Yes, right?
That was going to be a temporary situation. I think it was just, you know, it was romantic in and of its own self. But this idea that time has stood still, mm-hmm. that he embraces it as opposed to panicking, which is rule number one. If you find yourself in this situation, do not panic.
Do not panic.
Okay,
yes.
Good job, Greg Hill. We'll Thank remind you. People of that. But there's a whole set of other rules that... very much based on physics. I wonder how much physics did you study for this? It's like if he lets go of something, it would stay in midair and water wouldn't drip. So he had to come up with, well, then how do I eat or drink? How do I go to the bathroom? And these are all things that he has to ponder because of the nature of the universe, with things standing still and things not moving. So why did you get into so many of those details?
You know, people have asked me about that, and it's probably because various readers have said, you know, you got pretty into the woods of explaining all this stuff. And of course, it was just insecurity on my part as an author. And if, in fact, Narwhal voices that at one point. He says something about nerds, like, nerds, can you please explain what's going on here? But as far as the physics and so forth, before I wrote a word of this book, I created a spreadsheet, spent a couple days on it, and doing time conversion charts. For this, and I had to figure out the speed of the outside of a tornado, size of a tornado, speed of bullets, how fast, like, 4 miles an hour walking translates into time almost stoppage. And here's one thing I'm very proud of, is that I have a friend named Mike, and he read the book, and he created his own spreadsheet based on all the numbers I put in the book, and it came out the same as mine.
So you've been fact-checked.
Fact-checked.
And it's paid off, right?
It paid off. Right. Certainly there are things that are inexplicable, and I will confess, there's this running joke in the book about why don't the lights turn on and off? It's because it was inconvenient for the plot.
So Narwhal, when he thinks time is totally stopped, he doesn't think his actions have consequences so much. When he begins to learn that time might not be completely stopped, his actions start having consequences again. And isn't that kind of what starts? There's a turning point in the book. He starts changing. He has to, suddenly he has consequence again.
Precisely. And it's, so he's existed up to this point in his life believing that as the subconscious of a basketball game, he can do what he wants and there are no consequences, primarily because a game is a game, doesn't really matter. And before he realized his time's moving, he does some reprehensible things.
Well, tell us what he does to the truck driver. I thought that was something that could be a problem.
So he decides to start exploring. So he walks down the road, this two-lane highway, Highway 36, encounters a semi on the road. He's never been inside a semi, so he opens the door and looks inside and discovers that the truck driver discovers that the guy is an adulterer and loves fruit-based pornography. And
that's a genre, apparently. I didn't know until I read the
book. I made that up, but I'm sure you can make anything, and I guarantee you go online and there's going to be something about watermelon fetishists. But he, so he, and at this point, he's also discovered, Narwhal has discovered that his girlfriend may have cheated on him. So he's feeling very touchy about adultery or anyway. So he, what does he do? Oh, he takes the guy's, these dirty pictures that the truck driver had in his truck and covers the windows with them and basically sits and watches while the guy veers off the road.
Right. Well, when time is, he does it when he thinks time has stopped.
Yeah, sorry.
But then when he realizes time is going again and he's not anywhere near the trucker, he kind of comes to a realization like, that could be a problem.
Like, thank you for clarifying that. Because, so he covers up the guy's windows thinking, ha-ha, this is funny, no big deal, guy's going to be fine. Discovers time is moving, and he has to run back and drag the guy out of the truck because he can't, it's complicated. But he has to drag the guy out of the truck and put the guy on the road while the guy watches the truck smash into the ditch.
And this
and
is all happening incredibly slowly. We're talking about days and weeks, and this gets back to this idea of the physics behind all of this and your magic spreadsheet that apparently is all very accurate. That he ends up walking to Denver, and how long did that took him? Obviously a while, because he's way out in the Eastern Plains. But then when he realizes time hasn't in fact stood still, it's just moving slowly, and he's faced with the consequences of his actions, he's got to hightail it back to Denver, all on foot, because time has stood still, so there's no way to move a vehicle or cycle a bike or anything like that. So all of this plays out over, I mean, really long periods of time.
It does. And listener, I apologize if we're not making this clear, but imagine, so Narwhal, basically, the sun is setting at the beginning of the book, and it is set by the end of the book. So that's like 10 minutes pass over the course of the book. But in Narwhal's life, I don't know, months pass. I didn't do the spreadsheet on that. But so if he did, like, say, for instance, with the trucker, he realizes that he's left that. So he's several miles, like 50 miles away from where he abandoned the trucker. He realizes that time is moving. So he hustles back and saves the guy's life. But he didn't have to, like, fly an airplane because he can walk like 17,000 miles an hour.
Easily.
Yeah.
So I was hoping you could read a little bit of it. And what I want you to read is, so what's going on is there's this crazy storm brewing. And you have some great scenes where Narwhal walks through the storm and the drops are suspended in the air and how the clouds hang. And his first reason to think time is still going is he sees a slow bolt of lightning.
Yes.
And so something's got to be happening. So he finds out that there's a tornado, and he decides to approach it. And I thought maybe you could read a little passage about this.
And this is a good this is a good illustration of Narwhal's embrace of this weird world he's in. He discovers that he thinks things aren't moving. He thinks he's the last moving thing on Earth, and now he's not. Where am I starting here?
How about you start on the ground?
Okay. On the ground, I see. I have to point out that he's naked.
Yes.
In this scene, it's essential. He stripped his clothes so he could walk through the raindrops and clean himself off. And his clothes are standing somewhere at the edge of the storm, poised like scarecrows. A scarecrow. Okay. On the ground, I see a branch the size of a jousting lance. I lift it and poke it into the tornado. If you thought it was a thrill to watch a tornado, imagine what it's like to feel one tug a stick from your hand. I release the stick and watch as the tornado slowly, slowly consumes it. I'd be an idiot not to touch a tornado. I creep forward, knees bent, bracing to be whirled off my feet and into Oz. I outstretch my left arm, closer, closer. As I near the event horizon, particles of particulate begin to pelt me at a dreamish pace. I'm a magnet, and this dust and that pulverized silicate and this terrified fly and so forth cling to my rain-wet arm. I reach in further. I feel the tornado dust strike my back, my butt cheeks, my ear. I wish I'd left my clothes on. I feel the drag of the wind on my fingers. Another step and my hand is definitely inside the tornado. I grope about, enjoying the wind. It's like being breathed on by a sleeping dog. The sensation is brand new. I'm not making this happen. It's happening to me. I take a full step closer. I feel indecent and vulnerable, so I cover my crotch with my free hand. There's a football-sized mass passing in front of me. I reach for it and touch fur. It's a rabbit. Don't worry, buddy. I'll save you. I grasp a hind leg, crawl my hand to the scruff of the bunny's neck. You would think it'd be easy to extract a rabbit from a tornado, but this is not the case. I have to grasp it with both hands. When I try to yank the cuddly bunny out of the tornado, I have to lean on my heels, and even then the patient wind won't let go of the bunny. Oh boy, the patient wind won't let go of me either. The tornado hoists me closer, and soon my feet are no longer on the ground, and things are very, very serious.
And so this is a big moment, because he's been walking around for maybe a couple weeks at this point. Time is weird, because the sun is always in the same place. He doesn't know if he slept 4 hours or 8 hours or 12 hours, so he doesn't quite have days like we think of them. But seeing this tornado, something is happening to him.
Yes.
Because he's always making everything happen. And one of the great joys of this book is the little things that he makes happen. Like, to eat, luckily it's near dinner time. So he just walks into somebody's house, and if they're serving grilled cheese that night, he eats the grilled cheese sandwich and leaves. Or,
yes.
You know. So, but now the tornado is a force beyond. He's the only force in the universe for a while until he runs into the tornado.
And it's a sort of a referendum on narcissism, because once he realizes that the universe doesn't revolve around him, he's just moving very, very quickly in it, which is, at first he thinks the universe is moving slow, and then he realizes that he's moving fast, same difference. But it's a profound revelation for him to realize, I'm part of a greater thing. It's almost as if he'd read some Spinoza or something.
Author Gregory Hill is our guest today at the Radio Book Club, a collaboration between KGNU and the Boulder Bookstore. I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU. Arsene Keshkashian of the Boulder Bookstore is always my co-host. We're talking about Zebra Skin Shirt, and it's the third book in this trilogy that started with East of Denver, continued with The Lonesome Trials of Johnny Riles, which Greg actually paid a visit to the book club previously to talk about that. And this particular book, Zebra Skin Shirt, features Narwhal. Time has, well, he thought it has stood still, but we come to realise it's just moving very, very slowly. One of the aspects of this is the lack of sound and the fact that he can't hear people talk, obviously, but there's no sound because things are moving so slowly. And so he has this sensation in his head, even his own thoughts. He can't even hear his own voice. Well, why was that something? Because that wouldn't have been something I would have thought about when it comes to a narrative around time and time standing still. I mean, what was the interest that you had around sound?
I just love the idea. Well, I mean, if sound waves are traveling slowly, there's this literalist interpretation, time's moving slowly, so sound can't possibly happen for him. Obviously, there's a lot of physical jibber-jabber that, whatever, I don't care. This is a story. But to put him in that isolation tank in his own head, because he can hear himself talk, but it's only, you know, we cover your ears and you can hear your voice, but it's just the bones in his head moving his eardrums. So to make him super isolated, may I expand just a little bit on this?
Please do.
Okay. East of Denver. There was a progression with the three books. East of Denver is a kid who returns from Denver to the farm to help take care of his dad. And so he experiences this transition from a big populous city full of human beings and lots of noise to a small community where he has to just adjust. And then Johnny Riles, I made that even more confined, more, what's the word, claustrophobic, where Johnny is depressed. He lives on the ranch, and he just sort of drinks himself into isolation. And then eventually he finds this underground cave that is super isolated. And then the next step in sort of drawing, shrinking this circle around the person is this book, where now Narwhal can't hear anything. He has virtually no interaction with other humans. And then a neat thing happened with this is, if you're familiar with the first two books, the narrators are, they just don't express themselves very well. And especially Johnny Riles, you know how he's feeling, but not because he's expressing it, just because he's such a pathetic and honorable man. But Narwhal, what happens is that now that this world has shrunk so much, then boom, we pop into his head. And so we get this expansive, obnoxious, punning goofball who has thoughts and like just goes off on any subject. In a hilarious fashion, oftentimes, or offensive, or whatever. I don't care. So there. Did I answer anything?
I can't even remember what I asked you, but that was very entertaining, and yeah. I appreciate that. And I'm glad you brought in the connection with the other books. You could, of course, read any of these books on an individual basis, and just as a standalone book, they're great.
Yeah.
But there was something so incredibly satisfying when I recognized elements of the previous books in Zebra Skin Shirt. And it's like, aha. And it's, I feel like almost it's like a wink that you're giving out to maybe loyal readers who've read the previous ones, who will catch. There's little scenes, there's little snippets. It kind of almost is this, not a secret thing, but it's like, oh, I know that. And, you know.
Well, there's one of the things about East of Denver, that book ends on this ambiguous note. We don't know if the characters are going to live or die. And I got a lot of feedback from people who were unhappy with that, which to me it made the ending's great. It's the most beautiful ending of any book in the world, except for the other two I wrote. So then I brought back the ending to that book, but deliberately continued to not resolve it. So it was less a wink and more of a
headbutt.
A headbutt, yeah.
So, you know, what's so fascinating for the first, I don't know, up until the tornado scene, certainly, maybe even past that, the first 100 pages of the book is just Narwhal just poking around this world. Like, how does this work? Oh, you know, everything stopped. No, things are going back again. I have to go revisit and you know, get the truck driver out of the truck and get my girlfriend out of this crazy scene where I left her with a woman pointing a gun at her. And
we should talk about that, because that's a pretty problematic moment.
Yeah. So that's what I want to get to is, but you can't just have him. It's not like a diorama, right? You want him. You have to bring in plot. Like, as interesting as this world is that you have created, there really is, you know, how to bring in that tension, how to bring in that plot. You know, what came first, I guess, am I asking, and how did you develop the plot in this world?
Let's just start by saying I don't really pay attention to plot, and especially in this book. Everything, like my rule is it's the Robert Frost-based one, which is if a character can decide to do something normal, or if the plot decides it can go normal or it can go weird, we're going to go weird every time. So opportunity comes, let's embrace it. But what was your question?
So you have this setting.
Right.
So had you thought of an idea for the story, and then, or had you thought of the setting?
Sort of.
And then I want to see what happens in the setting.
Okay, so I knew while I was writing the Johnny Ryles, my second book, that a fastest man in the world character was going to come in and be involved in this arcane moment in Johnny Ryles. But beyond that, I had no idea what was going to happen. Here's how the story came to me, all right? My wife and I were eating at Gaetano's, an Italian restaurant in Denver. I went to the bathroom. I came out, and I was like, it would be really weird if time stopped. So then we sat at the bar and ate and talked to the bartender, and I wrote this idea on a coaster and brought it home, and then I wrote a book.
Now, where did that come in the sequence of the other two books? I mean, when you wrote East of Denver, did you have the other two books in your mind?
No, and East of Denver really doesn't really belong in the trilogy, I don't think. It exists in its own world. But Johnny Ryles, I was like halfway through Johnny Ryles, and I said, I've got to clarify some things for people.
But then you do create as the book goes on, an arc emerges. I don't want to say an arc, but Narwhal ends up having to learn more about himself, right? He, kind of like this consequence, that there are consequences in this slow-moving time world. And he's kind of on a quest, whether it's a quest for himself, to something, like, right? So that does start churning in this world, right?
It starts churning. I think we must remember that his intention when he left the bathroom in the diner initially and time discovers time had stopped, his immediate intention was to propose to his girlfriend, Veronica. So that's always in the back of his mind. But then, as with all my books, the characters, the main characters, have a need for just a strong mother figure, and they generally lack that. And so Narwhal, and via some crazy machinations, zebra nations, what about Narwhal? Oh, he starts discovering that there's this whole familial heritage, because Narwhal's an orphan, and he discovers all this wacky-ass crap going on in his life. So he gets sucked into this mystery of discovering the nature of his parents. But ultimately, and so he thinks that's his purpose on Earth, and time has been stopped for him. And then he also gets sucked into this preventing some crime. He's like, I'm a superhero, I'm preventing crimes. And then he thinks that's his purpose. So he keeps going from one explanation to another as to why he's trapped in this world. But that's not even. But none of that really has. The real reason he's trapped in this world is. It's basically the book, like all my books, is a Shaggy Dog joke.
You got to read to the end. Yeah. I mean, that's basically what it is. Veronica, I thought, was a really interesting character. Obviously, I mean, she's this woman he finds out once time has slowed down immensely, not stood still per se, that, you know, there's this potential betrayal. But, you know, when he goes through this mix of emotions and he goes on this avenging quest, but then he comes back to love her. But the challenge is, how do I communicate with Veronica once he realized that time was just actually going very slowly? So we devise this way of kind of holding notes up in front of her. So, but he needed to then understand whether she understood that. So she had to blink. But because of the way time is moving so slowly, it could take, a couple of days for a blink to happen.
I think at one point he had to go on a... I think that's why he takes a trip to Denver, because he has to kill like a month of his time just in order for Veronica to respond to one of these notes he's put up. It takes forever. So he tries to communicate with her as succinctly as possible. And somehow the amazing Veronica Vasquez gets what's going on instantly, in spite of the fact that she's in this diner where, from her perspective, the waitress and the chef and the other patron of the diner are seeing this sort of ghostly figure run around. So everybody's freaking out, but Veronica, with her just wonderful dedication and just general having it together, which is, again, my books generally have dumb men and women who tend to have their business together.
I was wondering, when we had that perspective that he needed to communicate all of this to Veronica, what it must be like for the people living in real time. Okay, so the whole book is really from the perspective of Narwhal, when things are going really slowly. But what is it like if you're just in the world and you've got somebody zipping around? Or, I mean, I wonder what your awareness would be.
I mean, they mentioned that a few times, but the real awareness doesn't seem to be of him as a ghost. It seems to be of like the grilled cheese sandwiches are gone. You had grilled cheese sandwiches on your plate.
Right.
It's gone. Like, right? That would be the real effect, it seems like.
Or like when he goes to the art museum and defiles it. And he finds Linda, the sculpture of the woman, the reclining woman. And he has this revelation. He's like, sculptural art is redundant to me because the whole world is composed of mannequins, essentially. And then he takes Linda and puts her in a stall in the men's restroom just to scare the poop out of somebody.
Literally. There were so many scenes like that. There was one where, I think, when he's walking on his way to Denver, was it a herd of antelope or something? He decides to put them into a pyramid.
A deer-a-mid.
And then when time then moves on ever so slowly, and then they fall over, and then he feels terrible remorse about this.
He does, because one of the antelope does not survive, or at least it's fatally injured, and then he feels compelled to finish the job. And then, out of this great shame, he decides that he has to consume a portion of this poor dead pronghorn, which doesn't go well for him. But this is just another, it's just this accumulation of the realization that human behavior has consequences, even when the world doesn't seem to notice it.
One of the things that I thought was interesting I want to touch upon is, so he reads, this is early in the book, he reads Veronica's diary. He sees that it looks like she's cheated on him.
Yes.
He's angry. He sets up the scene where the waitress has the gun pointing at him. He does the thing in the truck driver. But he has months to work through it, and he gets to forgiveness. It doesn't matter that much to him. But in real life, in real time, he probably would have, that relationship probably would be over. If he had read that journal, his reaction that first month of dealing with it would have killed that relationship. So I thought that was kind of an interesting thing about time. It's like the anger turns to forgiveness.
Right. And the horrifying way he displayed his anger, which we won't get into unless you want to. But because midway through writing this book, I got diagnosed with high-functioning autism spectrum disorder, which I call Burns disorder, after David Byrne. It's much easier on the face. But this book is a sort of a fantasy world for a high spectrum autism disorder person, because instead of like having these instant reactions to uncomfortable social situations, Narwhal gets to assess, come to a conclusion. I suppose it probably would apply to anybody. You get to think about things and then make a reasonable decision on it. And it's a fantasy land of personal irresponsibility that then doesn't matter.
Well, I actually just want to jump in here just as we finish up, and we will encourage people to subscribe to the podcast because we're going to do some more conversations with Greg Hill as part of After Hours. But in terms of that time moving so slowly, I find that so refreshing because I think we're in such a fast-paced world. Digital media, everything is instantaneous. Everyone has a knee-jerk reaction to slow everything down and to process things. I mean, albeit to this very extreme level for Narwhal, it was actually such a refreshing thing. And even the pacing of the book, it was refreshing for me to read it.
Oh, I love writing slowly. Things don't have to happen all at once. And I also have a rule that cell phones do not appear in my books unless they have to advance the plot. but just to let the human mind explore, that's where the fun stuff happens. I don't care about robots.
Well, people can read a lot more about this. It's Zebra Skin Shirt, the third in this trilogy by Gregory Hill. The first one, East of Denver, The Lonesome Trials of Johnny Riles, was the previous book Greg visited us at the book club for. You can read any of them as a standalone, but there's something, as I said, incredibly satisfying when you read all of them. You catch little snippets and it's just this recognition, aha moments happen throughout the book. Anyway, it was a great read. Thank you, Greg.
Thanks for having me, Maeve and Arson. You're wonderful people and I respect you.
We're going to have more with Greg Hill, including some music, because there's a bit of a kind of a soundtrack or musical accompaniment to this. We'll find out more in After Hours at the Radio Book Club podcast. But in the meantime, as we wrap up the radio portion, to let people know, there's a great opportunity coming up on Saturday, April 28th at 2:30 p.m. People can come to a live taping of the book club at the Boulder Bookstore's Independent Booksellers Day.
Yeah, we're going to have Peter Heller there with us. And he actually did this a couple years ago with us at Independent Bookstore Day. It was great fun. He did it for the book Celine back then. His new book is called The River. And it's going to be a kind of an outdoors mystery book. And, you know, it's the type of book Peter does well. And he's a very fun guy. We're going to have a good time there. A lot of laughs.
A good chat. That's at 2:30 p.m. at the Boulder Bookstore on Saturday, April 28th. We'd love you to come along as an audience member. And you can catch that broadcast on Thursday, May 23rd at 9 a.m. on KGNU. And don't forget, you can subscribe to the podcast, the Radio Book Club, and After Hours at the Radio Book Club. I'm Maeve Conran with KGNU. Arson Kashkashian, my co-host, as always. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.